You're listening to Ice World Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Taylor. All life in Antarctica revolves around the ocean. The largest non-oceanic species on the continent is a flightless midge, less than 2 centimetres long. This survives by eating bacteria, algae and nitrogen-rich waste produced by penguins. Meanwhile, around the coast, animals of all sizes, from plankton and krill to emperor penguins and elephant seals, feed, compete and reproduce, all entirely reliant on the ocean. But how can water this cold support this much life? Do they struggle to find the calories in their prey to sustain the energy demand of simply staying warm? And why are so many of the animals living here so large? To find out more, I spoke to the staff of the Bonner Research Laboratory, starting with Aurelia Reichard, the lab manager.
My name's Aurelia Reichard. I'm the Bonner lab manager here, so I manage our little marine and terrestrial lab here on Rotherhithe Research Station. I'm a marine biologist myself, but I've now sort of switched roles and have more gone into the side of managing scientists and managing a lab.
Contrary to what I had thought, the Bonner Lab doesn't just deal with life in the sea.
It also hosts terrestrial scientists looking at lichen and invertebrates that live on land around the station, which is probably not the most evident to people at times that there's terrestrial life as well as marine life. But probably the biggest emphasis of the Bonner Lab is marine science. We have an aquarium that runs with a flow-through system, which means that water from the ocean is directly taken up and fed into the aquarium. So the temperatures inside the aquarium are the same as in the sea outside, and the animals that live in the Antarctic are so temperature sensitive that it's really important to keep them in that cold temperature. So this is a big benefit of the Bonner Lab, is to have this aquarium. We have a lot of different science ongoing this season. There is long-term science, which is being conducted by two overwintering scientists. And there are seasonal projects that are being conducted by scientists who come visit for a few weeks up to a few months during the summer season. The long-term science projects that we have going on have to do with the impact of icebergs on the marine system. The projections are that with warming of the oceans, there will be less fast ice. And due to less fast ice, there will be a higher number of icebergs. And icebergs have the tendency to, they drift around with the wind and then they end up grounding. And when they ground, they do something that's called scouring, which means they ground on the sea floor and then get drifted around by the tides or by the wind. And due to that process, or in that process, they squish everything that's on the sea floor and destroying the community, which is an absolute natural process. However, due to climate change, it might be that the number of icebergs are increasing, therefore scouring events are increasing, which might have a negative impact on the communities.
So the hypothesis is that as global warming, global temperatures increase, there will be more icebergs calving off the glaciers, at least for a while, and that will have a huge impact just because of the purely mechanical action of these icebergs, chunks of ice dragging through the seabed and killing everything in their path.
Absolutely. And there are studies that have been conducted by scientists here at Rotherhithe who indicate this trend. We have a long-term experiment ongoing, which is called IBIS, Iceberg Impact Study. And it consists of different grids of little concrete blocks that we've laid out on the seafloor just outside the station, and we go visit them once a year to see how many of these little concrete blocks have been destroyed by icebergs, ranging from shallow grids to grids in 25 meter depth of water. And we try to use that to infer how many icebergs have been through within a year, and the trend definitely shows that there has been an increase in number of iceberg impacts.
Okay, that's one of your long-term projects. And obviously, is that ongoing in terms of years?
So this project has been ongoing for 17 years. And off this project, there are little smaller ones are sort of offshooting. So the current marine biologist who's just spent the winter living here at Rothera, she is looking at communities within that grid, and she's using the long-term data to see if communities have been recently hit by icebergs or if they haven't been touched for a few years. And she's looking at the different structure between those communities to see if the impact of icebergs has a an implication on which species grow, how big they are, how competition is between them, and basically how the ecosystem is shaped by the frequency of iceberg impacts.
I see. So we might have some species within a community that are more resilient to iceberg impact or make more use of the damage afterwards. They turn up and they recolonize that area faster than others.
Exactly. So you have species that can colonize faster, and then you have species that are more vulnerable to impact.
Okay, so that's one of your long-term projects. What else do you have long-term ongoing?
There's another long-term project ongoing that looks at the fertility or the reproduction of different species around Rothera. So once a month, the divers will go out and they will collect individuals of different specific species, and then these get sent back to the UK, and they try to relate the fertility of the animals to, for example, global warming trends or other trends that we see in the oceans. And so that's been ongoing for a few years, and they're still trying to link the findings to...
So you have results, but they haven't been published yet.
Exactly.
And will those be published soon, probably?
Hopefully, yes.
How cold is the water? What temperature is the water here at Rothera Point throughout the year?
So water temperatures are extremely low, but also extremely stable in comparison to, for example, temperate waters, where you might get a temperature range between 5 degrees or 3 degrees in the winter up to 25 or potentially even 27 degrees in the summer. Here in the Antarctic, or here at Rothera, the coldest you can get is -1.8 degrees, because that's when seawater freezes. But in the summer, the water doesn't really go above 2 to 2.5 degrees Celsius.
So that's very stable. That's a very small range that
exactly.
These animals are operating within.
Exactly. So that's what makes animals here in the Antarctic, or any creatures that are living here in the waters, extremely special, is that they're operating at these extremely low temperatures, but they're also experiencing this high stability, which means that they will be, or the predictions are, that they will be extremely vulnerable to warming in the water because they have been for such a long time so strongly adapted. They've lost this what we call plasticity, so they're not really able to adapt to a higher temperature range anymore because they've been so highly specialised now.
So what other long-term projects are going on?
So if we move away so from the biological and animal side of things and go more towards oceanography, the Rothera is special because for more than 20 years, a long-term monitoring series called RATS has been ongoing. So that's the Rothera Antarctic Time Series. And every week, a scientist goes out in the summer twice a week, in the winter once a week, goes out and measures the water column at a special point in the bay. So that point is 500 meter deep, and they measure the water with a sensor called CTD, which stands for conductivity, temperature and depth. So basically it measures the temperature, the salinity of the water, and it relates it to the depth. And then they take water samples that they bring back to the lab and measure different small algae that are within the water. They measure nutrients. They preserve samples for oxygen isotopes and for other analyses that they're sending off to different collaborating institutes. And this ongoing time series is extremely valuable because it's the only one that we have here in the Western Arctic Peninsula.
How long has that been going on for?
For over 21 years now.
And is this done in other locations as well in exactly the same way? Or is this only done at Rothera? For example, do you have someone doing the exact same experiments elsewhere in the oceans?
So the procedures and the analysis are pretty standard for generally for oceanography, but in this comprehensive way, They're very unique to Rothera. On the research vessels that are coming down to the Antarctic, similar procedures are being done. So we have data that we can compare to other places and other research stations and to the research vessels that are operating in the Southern Ocean.
So that's been every week for 21 years.
Yeah, sometimes in the winter when the sea is frozen and there's a blizzard outside, then we tend to not go.
That's understandable. So this spot that's 500 metres deep, obviously normally you would access it by boat. But when the sea ice is in, is it easy enough to get out to it? How far away is it from the shoreline?
It's a few kilometres away from the shoreline. So it takes us about, on a non-icy day, it takes us about 20 minutes to get there by rib. In the winter, I've not personally experienced this myself, but in the winter, if the sea ice is thick enough and has been tested by special field guides, then we can take a snowmobile and a chainsaw and a lot of hot water bottles and a lot of warm clothing, and we can travel that distance with the snowmobile on the sea ice and cut a hole into the sea ice to then lower our instruments through. It takes a lot of effort to do that. It's a full day job, but the data is so unique and so hard to get that it's absolutely worth it.
Any other long-term projects?
There are some terrestrial long-term projects that are ongoing. Part of my job is to do a skua survey. So skuas are birds that nest around station, and they nest in the hills around station, and in the summer that chicks might hatch. So once a week I go out and I count the nests and I see which bird pairs that have been ringed have returned and have formed couples to lay eggs, and then I go out later during the season and see if the eggs have hatched and what the hatching success is, and I measure the chicks.
Do you enjoy getting dive bombed?
Yeah, it's definitely worth it to take a climbing helmet and a long flag. So if you stick a flag,
they dive bomb the flag.
If you stick a flag in your backpack, exactly, or you take you take someone else who's keen to
a
bit of science and taller, exactly, to wave a flag around while you GPS the nest locations.
So what are the short term projects you've got happening at the moment?
So every season, it's a little bit different. We might get visiting scientists that return for 2 or 3 years at a time because they've received funding that allows them to come back multiple years after another. Or we might get scientists who've come in on what's called a CAS project, which is a small project that usually only goes on for 2 or 3 months. And sort of, let's say, a bit of a gap filler between the big international funded projects. We have a project this season by one of the scientists at Bass, who is looking at the temperature tolerance of animals here in the Antarctic, and he will be looking at basically stress. So he will warm up, he will expose the different animals to different temperatures, and then measure how much oxygen they consume. So the more stressed an animal is, the higher the metabolism and the more oxygen it will consume. So that's a really good way of seeing how stressed the animals are. Because if you look at a starfish, you're not going to be able to tell.
No, it just lies there.
Exactly. Sometimes it might move faster, sometimes it might move a bit slower, but it's a little bit different with seals and penguins where you have behaviour.
They're more similar to ourselves. We can relate to them a bit more.
Exactly. So this, what's called respirometry, is a really good way of telling how stressed animals are, and to relate that to the water temperature. And then there's a visiting scientist who's been down a couple of times. She's been down last year as well, and she looks at glaciers. So she looks at how the melting of the glaciers influences the iron within the ocean. So iron gets input into the ocean by, for example, storms that blow sand or any terrestrial material from the land into the ocean, thereby fertilizing it. So, for example, areas off of the Sahara are really high in iron because they get fertilized by the desert. The problem with the Southern Ocean is that because the Antarctic is not connected to any of the other continents and is covered in ice and glaciers, there's not a lot of terrestrial material that is blown off into the sea. So the sea is not as rich in iron. So Amber will be looking at how the melting of glaciers maybe influences the influx of iron and terrestrial material into the ocean, and to see how meltwater, what influence meltwater has on the iron availability in the ocean.
And iron, of course, obviously, I suspect if you get a huge amount of iron dumping into the ocean, that'll have a huge effect in, for example, algal blooms.
Exactly. So in areas where nutrients are high, so nitrate and phosphate and other nutrients that algae might need to grow, where these are high, other things become limiting factors. And that quite commonly is iron. So there are some theories that if we were to take a lot of iron and dump it into the ocean...
This has been tried.
So they've done a few studies in the Southern Ocean where they've tried to fertilize the... they've tried to fertilize what's called mesoscale eddies. So basically, if you imagine the big gyres that are going on in the world oceans, so the big currents are sort of going around in circles, an eddy is the same thing, but on a very small... Not on a mesoscale, so on a medium scale. So it's still a big enough system, but it's sort of isolated. So if you were to fertilize iron into the middle, then the idea is that the impact would only be within that eddy area, because it would be contained by the current itself, or by the gyrating of the eddy. But yeah, it's definitely not gone to plan, and it's going into that geoengineering. The idea behind it, as you say, makes a lot of sense, because that's the normal cycle. Algae would bloom, would bind a lot of, use a lot of CO2 from the ocean, and ultimately from the atmosphere, would bind it in their biomass, and then they eventually die and sink out. But as you say, along the way, it needs to be in a certain balance. If you have too much biomass dying, then it's the same as if you have a pond and at some point when it gets too green, it turns and all of a sudden it becomes anoxic and there's no oxygen anymore, because all of the oxygen has been used up by bacteria decomposing the algae, and then the entire system...
It killed a huge number of fish, did it not?
I'm not quite sure.
So that leads us on to the subject of blue carbon storage. And there's research ongoing here about blue carbon storage in... kind of post-glacial sill, is that not right?
Exactly. So Nadesha, the scientist I've mentioned before who's just spent a winter here, she has, apart from the iceberg impact study, she's also had a look at blue carbon and blue carbon sinks. But you'll probably have to ask her for a bit of, more in-depth information about that.
Aurelia, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
I went with Aurelia's suggestion and managed to sit down with Nadesha to find out more about the work she does.
So my name is Nadesha Tveshki and I'm the marine biologist.
And what does that entail? What's your normal working week for you as a marine biologist?
So normal working week is we do a lot of lab work, but also... go diving and on the boats a lot.
Why don't you tell me about the projects, the long-term ones and any short-term ones that you're working on at the moment?
Okay, so I was actually quite lucky when I came down. I came down on a research cruise, and that is a three-year project looking at the impact of glacial retreat on the seabed and the animals living there.
What about, you're doing some work on sediment left behind by retreating glaciers and blue carbon capture.
Yeah, so that was part of the research cruise we've been working on. So the idea behind that is that glacial retreat causes or forms a new habitat that we don't usually have in Antarctica. So it's a low energy habitat which has sediment on the bottom. So generally around Antarctica, most areas are covered by rock or cobble, and sometimes a very small layer of sediment, but not very much. But with this retreat of the glaciers, we get these low energy environments, basically fjords systems, which help in the long run to decrease carbon in the atmosphere.
As I understand it, as a glacier retreats, it leaves behind this sediment.
Yes.
And certain creatures can make their home in this sediment.
Yeah.
And the carbon dioxide that they capture then is something that has to be fed into models for climate change because it will have a damping effect.
Yeah, so that's basically the gist of it. So carbon sequestration or removal from the atmosphere runs in three stages. So you've got the first stage of carbon capture, which is usually done by plants, trees, etc. And in part of the ocean, it's phytoplankton. And because we're seeing this retreat of the glaciers and lower amount of sea ice, the duration of phytoplankton in the Antarctic Circle is actually increasing, which means that the animals living in these newly created environments can feed on them. And that's the second stage, where it's carbon storage. And usually on land, that would be also done by plants, like trees. But in the ocean, it's the animals that feed on the phytoplankton. And then we go into carbon removal. And this is actually one of the problems that we're having with on land, is that we seldom get the removal out of the system, because as trees, if a tree is getting old and falls over, it degrades and the carbon is being released again into the atmosphere. While if we're down in the ocean on the sediment and we're having that glacier retreat, it's causing more and more sediment to appear, which means the animals are actually being buried. And as they're being buried, they're being taken out of the system. They're being buried to a degree that they're in anoxic environments, which means there's no oxygen around, which means there's a low chance of... There will be bacteria, but not a lot, and a specific kind. And these will degrade the carbon, but it means the carbon can't get back into the cycle.
So that carbon is then considered to be captured?
That carbon is then considered to be captured and taken out of the system. And I think the definition for that is that carbon has to be taken out of the system at least for 100 years.
So okay.
That is what we're finding there.
So you've been taking sort of sediment cores, is that right?
Yeah, so we've been looking at sediment cores and looking at the different depths of the sediment cores to see what kind of animals, or whether there's animals in these cores.
And are you doing the analysis here, or are those cores being transported?
No, I've started doing the analysis here. So what I've done so far is identify all the species we had in the course, and established how much carbon they've contained. So at the moment we are looking at the statistical analysis and seeing whether there's any pattern relating to their proximity to the glacier, to possible moraines, or drop stones, and whether there's any difference between sites along the Antarctic Peninsula. So we did take samples in the Bellingshausen Sea, for example, as well, which is a bit colder and which has a bit of a different oceanography, bathymetry, than we have in Ryder Bay, for example. So the way to establish carbon in or organic mass is you dry the animal, and then you have their biomass, and then you burn them, which then gives you the ash-free mass, which means all the carbon, all the organic matter has been burned off. So, and then you subtract that from the biomass, which, and then you have the carbon mass, or the organic mass of that animal. And then we use a formula to estimate how much of that was carbon.
And the information from this research that you're doing, obviously this is relevant to other things as well, but also to climate change. Will this be plugged into various models that are used to predict the impact of climate change?
Yeah, so the work on blue carbon sequestration is actually fairly new. A lot of work on this has been done for terrestrial systems, but the fact that this is also happening in the ocean is a fairly new development.
And I think many of our listeners will be familiar with, you know, carbon storages, biomass, and, you know, peat bogs and things like that. That's been fairly well covered by the popular press.
Yeah.
But the idea that, I suppose, also potentially rise in sea levels will lead to more ocean area.
Yeah, this is true. And the fact, so the thing that we're finding with the glacial retreat and the ability of these new environments to store carbon and sequester carbon is actually that it's one of the only areas that is a negative feedback on climate change. So when you're looking at other systems that are carbon storage systems, such as the rainforest or seagrass beds,
it's a positive feedback kind of thing a lot of the time.
Exactly, it's a positive feedback climb, because with increasing climate change, these areas will decrease, which means we're having less and less carbon storage happening in these areas, which means climate change will be increased and accelerated. Yes. Well, with the glacial retreat, as climate change accelerates or increases, we're having more and more glaciers retreating, creating more and more areas for carbon sequestration in Antarctica. So in the long term, generating a negative feedback, because these areas will just be there and will increase with increasing climate change.
That's interesting. How long do you think it will be until you have some results or potentially a paper published?
So we're getting some more data in by January, and hopefully get that analysed fairly soon. So we're hoping to publish something on it possibly next year. But there's already a paper coming out, which is more like a preliminary estimation of how much carbon we could possibly, these areas are probably containing. And we've worked on that during the last cruise coming down, just from estimating how much glaciers have retreated over the time and how much area has been created, and an approximate estimation of how much biomass you have in these areas in terms of species. And that was derived from photographic images from the area. So we kind of know what animals live there, and we could kind of that way estimate carbon stock, okay, if you like.
And have you any preliminary results yet, or are you still kind of waiting on more analysis and more data?
So we're waiting on a bit more data. What we're finding so far is that the upper layers of the sediment are quite diverse in species abundance. So we probably need to take a few more samples to get a significant result either way, or have a statistically valid result, really. But yeah, we found that, you know, there is, I mean, these cores we're taking, they are very small. They're about 10 centimeters in diameter, maybe. So that's not a lot if you think how vast and how big the seabed is. So it's a very, very small sample size that we're taking. And because of the constraints and the expense of research on the ship, we can't take that many more. We took as much as we possibly could, but that maybe relates to 8 cores per site, which again is not a lot if you think about how small they are.
I see. So any extrapolation from that will be prone to quite large errors.
Yes, exactly. So we're looking to increase. So we defined where we get most of the variation from within the core. So now we can increase our sample size and reduce the effort for it, because we know most of the variation comes from the first 5 centimeters of the core. So we can, in future, can take more samples but only analyze the first 5 centimeters. So we know that the rest is probably fairly stable in species assemblages or in the kind of species you find in there. But the first 5 centimeters is more varied. So to get a more valid result, we need more samples for that. We submitted it to the Journal of Climate Change Biology, and it's in review, and we're waiting to hear back at the moment.
Cool. Well, good luck. That's one to have a look out for if they have access to these journals.
Definitely, yeah.
Alicia, thank you very much for coming on the show.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Finally, I wanted to learn more about the challenges of diving in Antarctic waters and the special techniques that our divers use to cope with the conditions here.
I am Calm Stronach, and I'm the Field Diving Officer at the Rother Research Station.
And what does your job entail?
My job is to facilitate diving operations for the marine science that happens here on base.
Okay, how did you end up getting this job? What's your background?
Long story. My background is I started off as a child loving marine life, marine science, and diving. I went to university in Edinburgh at Harry Watt, and I studied marine biology, after which I started getting more into technical diving, dive master, became a commercial diver, but I always had this passion for marine science. And as time went by, I repeatedly applied to the British Antarctic Survey program, 6 times in total, and eventually, after many, many years, I got accepted as the field diving officer.
Talk us through the kind of routine of dives that you have. So how many do you do a week or a month? And do you have a set schedule of dives that you have to do?
We do have set schedule of dives. At least once a month, we collect animal samples from various parts of our dive limits as part of a monthly collection. Now, this collection goes to a long-term project known as the RMAST collection. And that's to study growth, reproduction, and just how these animals grow in the cold waters around Marguerite Bay. It's really quite fascinating, and it should give us a greater insight as to how these animals develop.
So what difference does cold water make versus warm water to how animals develop here?
Well, the big difference really is that cold water really slows down these animals' growth and metabolism. They are very, very slow, very slow growing animals. In fact, some of the shellfish we have are hundreds of years old. It's really quite fascinating. But because of that slow development, they take a long time to recover from any environmental damage. And so we really need to know how long it takes for these damaged environments to regrow with the animals around the area.
And why do so many of these animals grow so large here?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Much like the very deep oceans, the waters around Marguerite Bay and, more importantly, Rothera, are really, really cold. And as such, that cold, cold water retains much more oxygen than warm water does. And as such, we get this examples of marine gigantism, like you see with giant deep sea crabs. And around here, we see it in some of the sea spiders, which in the UK you might find the size of your thumbnail, but here they can be the size of your hand. It's really quite remarkable.
What are the challenges in terms of the techniques and different things you have to do to dive here compared to, say, diving in Europe?
Well, for starters, it is much, much colder. And because it's so much colder, you have to wear a much thicker undersuit. That is the suit we wear under our dry suits to keep us warm and insulated so you don't freeze on your travel to and from the dive site as well as the dive itself. We use 7mm neoprene dry suits to keep ourselves warm, and we use the neoprene purely because of the insulating factor it gives on top of the undersuit itself. Logistically, the regulators we use Poseidon Cyclones, which are designed for cold water diving. But even still, the waters around here get down to -2 during the winter. It is actually freezing. And even such, they still really struggle. So we use glycerin inside those regulators to act as an antifreeze to stop them freezing even still.
And what about, for example, sea ice? What sort of what additional work do you have to do to dive underneath or near the sea ice?
Sea ice is incredible to see, beautiful from an angle, but to work with it is a lot of hard work. If we want to dive and the sea ice is formed across the bay, to get to our favourite dive sites, to get these samples of importance, we have to break out the giant chainsaw we have on base. We use a Still 880. It is the largest commercial saw you can buy. We this year had to use a 101, that's a 1 metre and 10 centimetre bar, to cut through the sea ice because it grew so thick, and involves cutting two dive holes for the dive team, one to primarily dive through and access these samples, and a second hole in case seals decide to steal the first one.
Is that a case of the seal decides that the hole now belongs to them and they're going to use it, so they won't let you near it?
Absolutely, that's it, spot on. The seals, obviously during the winter, there's not many opportunities for them to break through the sea ice and get the air they need. So Weddell seals in particular, they'll use their teeth to grind holes and find these little air holes to breathe. But if they find the divers have chopped a gigantic hole, they'll take it. They'll take it as their own, and they get quite defensive. So we always have a backup hole in case one of the Weddells decides it's going to make the hole its own. And it still gives our divers a safety margin to get out if they have to.
What kind of do you have communication with your fellow divers when you're underwater?
Absolutely. Communication is paramount down here, just as a safety measure. We use a mixture of hardwire comms, that is, the divers are physically wired to the surface team and they can communicate to each other, the surface team, and anyone related to the dive operations. It's incredibly safe and it's quite fun to talk to.
Do you do a bit of underwater photography? What kind of species do you see and photograph?
We do quite a bit of underwater photography, actually, both for the IBIS grids, which is the long-term study of iceberg impacts in the shallow waters around Rothera, And we also do a lot of photography just because the animals here are so beautiful and we still don't know that much about them. So the more photo IDs, the more we can find, photograph, show to people, we take any opportunity we can. Sometimes with a GoPro, sometimes with something a bit more heavy. Antarctica should never be off the list of places you can dive, really. It's always seen as this forbidden continent that you can never get to. It's inaccessible, unobtainable, incredibly expensive, but from my experiences doing an entire calendar year here in Rothera, it's one of the greatest pleasures I've ever had, and the diving doesn't compare to anywhere else, really. If you want it, you can get it.
That's cool. How much would someone pay for a trip south to Antarctica to dive?
That's a tough question. It depends who you go with, what you want to see, and if you're bringing your own gear or not, it can range from a few thousand to a few tens of thousands. Okay. It can be quite expensive.
That's less than I thought, though.
It sounds it, but you've also got to remember, you might have to bring all your own gear with that. So you might have to bring your suit, regulators, fins, mask, gloves, hood, a variety of gear and heavy items. So that mounts up in the cost just to have the gear to dive here, let alone actually paying to have someone take you out.
So talk us quickly through the prep for, say you're going out to collect some samples. How many people are involved with the prep and the actual diving?
Quite a number of people. A lot more than most people think. So obviously, you will have two divers. One as the primary science diver. That is, they're the one doing the collections, photography, or the actual science. And the second diver will be what we call the safety diver. That is the person that's looking after the first diver, focused entirely on the science. That is, they can dedicate all their focus into one small area, while the other diver is keeping a general look around, making sure it's safe, looking out for marine mammals that may be of concern, and just keeping an eye on the operations underwater, really. On top of that, you'll have a supervisor, and that will be the person running the dive, keeping an eye on things on the surface, essentially running the whole dive operation. You'll have a boating officer that will be driving the boat to access some of the dive sites we have around here. And in addition to that, if we're using the hardwire communications, which are, I would definitely say, the most important part, it will have an extra person on the boat called the line tender. Now, this is the person that's running the lines, making sure they don't get tangled, they're neat on the boat, and it gives the supervisor a bit of comfort that they can focus on the dive itself, logistics, seals, etc., without having to focus on the lines as well. It frees up their mind, and it just makes the dive much smoother for everyone involved.
Could you tell us how the atmospheric pressure here is different than elsewhere, and how does that affect diving?
I have to say, I've never experienced this anywhere else in the world. It's definitely a unique challenge to Rothera. That is, we get so many strange pressure fronts that come through that really drop the air pressure, like quite significantly. Anywhere else in the world, to get that simulated pressure drop, you'd have to go into the Andes, into mountains, Kilimanjaro, you know, thousands of feet up into altitude, essentially. And down here in Rothera, you can be at complete sea level floating a boat. But the atmospheric pressure will be that equivalent to 2,000 feet. It's really quite remarkable. However, this really impacts our divers, and we have to adjust our diving tables to account for that incredible pressure drop.
Callum, thank you very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, thank you.
You've been listening to Ice World, a podcast on behalf of the British Antarctic Survey. If you want to learn more about the survey's work in Antarctica and beyond, please visit our website at www.bas.ac.uk. Thank you for listening.